I'm Susan Yawkey with VOA's Middle East Monitor podcast. Coming up, Syrian rebels free Iranians in a prisoner exchange. The WFP speaks out about a food emergency in Syria. Assessing the prospects for a Middle East peace.
A two-state solution might be given up on, and that would be a disaster for everybody.
And a U.S. firm pays $5 million to settle an Iraqi detainee suit. It's all ahead. A group of 48 Iranians have arrived at a hotel in Syria's capital, Damascus, after spending almost half a year in captivity in Syria. The Iranians were released by the Syrian opposition in an exchange which saw more than 2,000 Syrians set free. Saleh Hennessy reports from our bureau in London.
Observers said the Iranians arrived at the hotel in Damascus looking tired but healthy. They were met by Iran's ambassador. The Syrian government released more than 2,000 prisoners in exchange, although there's been no official confirmation from the government. A Turkish humanitarian group, the Humanitarian Relief Foundation, says it helped mediate the deal. Vice President Hussein Oruç told VOA that 2,130 people had been released by the Syrian government, including four Turks. He says the exchange went smoothly.
There's no problem. All changing have been completed. 48 Iranians have reached Damascus, and the Syrians are reaching to their families.
The 48 Iranians were kidnapped from a bus in Damascus in early August. Iran says they were religious pilgrims, but the rebels say they're members of Iran's Revolutionary Guards and were on a reconnaissance mission in order to help Syrian President Bashar al-Assad, a close Iranian ally. Iran's foreign minister has said some of those kidnapped were once members of the Revolutionary Guards, but are retired. Oruç says the exchange negotiations included Iran, Qatar, Turkey, and the Syrians. He says his organization has more work to do, freeing prisoners on both sides of the conflict.
You know, there is thousands of the people still in the jail in Syria, and we are conducting this humanitarian diplomacy to releasing of the all civilians from the side of the opposition and from the regime, from the government.
David Hartwell is a Middle East analyst at IHS Jane's in Britain. He says the Syrian government has a long history of taking political prisoners, and those numbers have increased rapidly since the current conflict began. Wednesday's hostage exchange is significant, he says, but many more are still in captivity.
We don't have exact figures on how many people have been rounded up by the regime in the last 18 months. I think it's important to caveat that there are allegedly tens of thousands, if not more, prisoners being held by the Syrian regime at the moment.
Russian and U.S. diplomats will hold talks with the international mediator for Syria, Lakhdar Brahimi, in Geneva on Friday. Saleh Hennessy for VOA News, London.
As Saleh mentioned, officials from the United States and Russia are expected to meet Friday in Geneva with United Nations Arab League envoy for Syria, Lakhdar Brahimi. Michael Williams is a former UN Undersecretary General for the Middle East and currently a distinguished fellow, visiting fellow at Chatham House in London. We asked him what he expects to happen at the talks.
I suspect not a great deal, but I do strongly welcome the meeting. I think it's very good that the U.S. and Russia are meeting together with Mr. Brahimi, the UN envoy. The outlook on the ground remains grim, and President Assad made a fairly strident and tough speech only a few days ago on Sunday. So I think there's very little mood for compromise in Damascus. So it remains what can be done in the talks in Geneva.
Why do you think they're holding the talks then?
I think because of the very seriousness of the situation. And I think it is good that Russia has accepted to have these talks. It could be that Mr. Brahimi, who has a very tough job and, of course, already follows on the heels of Kofi Annan, who resigned, it could be that Mr. Brahimi has taken the initiative in asking them together and may say to them, look, unless there is common ground between Washington and Moscow, my job is impossible.
Do you think Russia might be adjusting its position a little bit in the last couple of weeks?
I've been looking for that. The Russian media tended to report President Assad's tough speech last Sunday in a fairly sort of straight manner. But I haven't detected any note of criticism of the speech, either from Russian officials or, frankly, even in the Russian media.
The opposition pretty much wrote off the Syrian leader's address, saying it wasn't anything new. Does the opposition need to do something?
I think there are problems in the opposition. It's not as coherent as and organized as countries like the U.S. and Britain and France would like to see. On the other hand, you know, the speech here was so tough. I mean, talking about them being puppets of the West and that he wouldn't deal with anybody that that had taken up arms against his regime. So if we were hoping for an olive branch from President Assad last Sunday, we certainly didn't see it.
Well, if you were stuck in Brahimi's shoes, what would you do?
I think I'd talk very frankly with William Burns from the U.S. and Mr. Bogdanov from Russia and say, look, all of us want to see peace in Syria, but I can't see much future for my mission as it is now. And the only hope is if we can find common ground between the two most important external actors, the U.S. and Russia.
Michael Williams, a former U.N. Undersecretary General for the Middle East and a fellow at Chatham House in London. Twenty 2012 was the deadliest year on record for journalists, with over 100 killed in their line of work. The United Nations is spearheading a new drive to improve safety for journalists around the world. Henry Ridgewell reports from London.
Shells fall on the Syrian city of Homs in February 2012. A building used by foreign media takes a direct hit, killing renowned Sunday Times correspondent Marie Colvin, along with French journalist Remy Ochlik. Photographer Paul Conroy is injured. From a makeshift bed, he describes what he saw to the rebel fighters he's working alongside.
We took a direct hit somewhere. I was injured in the leg. I think my colleague Marie Colvin is dead, and Remy also is dead.
The incident was among the most high-profile of 2012, but there were many more fatal attacks on members of the media. Many of them were specifically targeted for their reporting. William Horsley is from the Centre for Freedom of the Media at the University of Sheffield.
You have not only this consistent rise in the number of killings of journalists to stop them reporting about crime, corruption and abuse of power, but in the last couple of years, especially in North Africa, from Somalia to Syria, you've got war again.
Exact figures vary, but the UN says over 100 journalists were killed doing their job in 2012. Late last year, at a conference in Vienna, the United Nations launched its action plan on the safety of journalists and combating impunity. Again, William Horsley.
What's needed is the public and the press to make the world, the populations, understand the link between the killing of journalists and the undermining of the rule of law and stability in whole societies.
At an October symposium at the BBC College of Journalism, members of the world's media gathered to discuss attacks on journalists. Nearly 20 Somali journalists were killed in 2012 alone. And Omar Farouk Osman of the Somali National Union of Journalists says some of the murders have been brutal.
Not only journalists are killed in Somalia by bullets, they are also killed by beheading. In our life, we have never seen journalists beheaded.
Pakistani media are also under threat for their coverage of schoolgirl activist Malala Yousafzai, now discharged from a British hospital after being shot in the head by the Taliban. Hamid Mir of GOTV in Pakistan talks about the threats.
The Taliban have announced open war against Pakistani media because we are supporting the little girl Malala Yousafzai.
Bob Tyra, associate editor of the Sunday Times of London, wants much tougher legal protection for the media.
I think that the killing of journalists should be a crime against humanity.
American freelance reporter James Foley has not been seen since he was kidnapped by unidentified gunmen in Syria in November. It is another reminder of the dangers of the job, dangers that appear to be getting worse. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, London.
The United Nations says about a million Syrians are living without adequate food and serious fuel shortages, and rising violence are disrupting aid distribution across the war-torn country. UN World Food Program spokeswoman Elizabeth Burrs discussed the situation with VOA's Mark Snowis.
The humanitarian needs in Syria, especially for food, are growing. We have in Syria a serious bread and fuel shortages across the country, and also 85% of the people we help are people who are displaced. WFP, the World Food Program, is reaching about 1.5 million people monthly in Syria with food assistance. And we also assist 1,000 more Syrians in neighboring countries. So far, we are facing several challenges. First of all, the shortages of fuel. And this had an impact on the deliveries of food assistance by truck, and also our implementing partner, which is the Syrian Arab Red Crescent, is stretched to the limit and has no more capacity to expand further. That's why we would need more implementing partner NGOs on the ground to distribute humanitarian food assistance.
What is the main obstacle to that?
We have several obstacles. The first obstacle is insecurity and violence in some violence-hit areas. The fuel shortages, of course. And altogether, we have reached in November less people than we expected. We have reached 1.4 million instead of the 1.5 million we hope and we aim to reach in Syria in January.
What's the obstacle to getting more implementing partners?
The obstacle to get more implementing partners is to get people ready to distribute and to assist. We need to find more NGOs ready to work with us. And it's not easy. Apart from the Syrian Arab Red Crescent and a few local charities, we have no more other NGOs or people ready to do the job.
But are you saying that international agencies don't want to go in, or are you saying the Assad regime won't let them in?
No, we are saying that we need more partners. The Emergency Relief Coordinator of the UN launched an appeal before the holiday season to ask more international NGOs to come on. And we hope to see more people on the ground to support the effort of the Syrian Arab Red Crescent. To be very clear, WFP is providing assistance in both government and opposition control areas. The only places were affected by heavy fighting are places which nobody can reach, including the Red Crescent and local charities and NGOs. So we reach both government and opposition controlled area. The only difficulty and limit constraints is the security situation.
UN World Food Program spokeswoman Elizabeth Byers in Geneva. The UN estimates 4 million people in Syria need urgent humanitarian aid, including an estimated 2 million displaced from their homes by fighting between forces loyal to President Bashar al-Assad and rebels trying to topple him. The number of registered Syrian refugees in neighboring countries has increased from 500,000 to nearly 600,000 in the past month, according to the UN Refugee Agency. Negotiations for a lasting peace between Israel and the Palestinians have been stalled for more than 2 years. In this report from Washington, VOA senior correspondent Andre Dineshra spoke with three former high-ranking U.S. government officials about the prospects of reviving the peace process.
The key issues are well known. They are the geographic outlines of a new Palestinian state, the status of Jerusalem, the return of Palestinian refugees, Israeli settlements in occupied territories, and security arrangements. Peace talks ground to a halt in September 2010 when Israel resumed the construction of settlements after a moratorium expired. Palestinian officials say they will not resume negotiations until settlement building is stopped. Israel refuses to freeze settlements and is calling for talks to begin again without preconditions. Experts say one stumbling block to the peace process is the division in Palestinian leadership between the West Bank and the Gaza Strip. The West Bank is run by Mahmoud Abbas's Palestinian Authority, while the Gaza Strip is under the control of the militant organization Hamas, considered a terrorist group by Israel and the U.S. State Department. Former U.S. National Security Advisor Brent Scowcroft, who served under Presidents Gerald Ford and George Herbert Walker Bush, says the Palestinians must show a united front.
If Hamas can't be induced, if you will, to join with Fatah and really pursue the peace process, then a two-state solution might be given up on, and that would be a disaster for everybody. I think this notion that the two-state solution is just out there forever may be a mistake.
Last November, Hamas and Israel fought a week-long conflict. The militant group bombarded Israel with hundreds of rockets. Israel responded with airstrikes in Gaza. The fighting eventually stopped after Egypt brokered a ceasefire. John Bolton, former U.S. ambassador to the United Nations under President George W. Bush, says the conflict benefited Hamas and Iran.
Hamas actually emerges from the ceasefire in a stronger position. They defied Israel and they live to tell about it. And Iran also emerges in a stronger position. They've demonstrated what many long expected or feared, that they could put missiles into the hands of Hamas in the Gaza Strip, that they could reach Israeli population centers like Jerusalem and Tel Aviv.
As for Fatah, the United Nations General Assembly last November gave President Abbas a rare international diplomatic victory by recognizing Palestine as a non-member observer state, the same status as the Vatican. Once again, John Bolton.
It was another exercise in fantasy by the UN General Assembly. There is no Palestinian state, so having a majority in the General Assembly say there is one isn't going to create it. But despite its disconnect from reality, the resolution, I think, could have significant political effects, given that the Palestinians can take this status as a state in international law, go to the International Court of Justice, go to the International Criminal Court, accede to a number of other treaties, and try and use that for political advantage, I think it will have consequences.
Experts are divided as to whether Fatah's diplomatic win and Hamas's more dominant position will have any effect on the stalled peace process. They say one thing is certain. The United States must play a more active role in advancing that process. But William Cohen, former U.S. Defense Secretary in the Clinton administration, says the United States has a problem.
The United States, frankly, has not had the perception of being an even-handed broker, because the United States, its strong commitment to Israel, and I think many of the Palestinians see this as not being fair-handed or even-handed, being a, quote, honest broker.
Despite that, Cohen says the United States is the only country capable of being an honest broker.
We're the only ones that can, because I think certainly from the Israeli point of view, they have great trust in the United States, which is justified. And I think we have to continue to reach out to the Palestinians to say that we are committed to helping to achieve a two-state solution. And if we no longer intend to carry out that role, then obviously we're not going to be able to help bring about a successful negotiation.
Some experts believe U.S. President Barack Obama will have a unique opportunity during his second term in office to revive the Middle East peace process. But analysts say any action on that front will wait until after the Israeli parliamentary elections, scheduled January 22nd. Andre Dineshner of VOA News, Washington.
A U.S. defense contractor that helped detain and interrogate prisoners during the Iraq War has paid more than $5 million to settle a lawsuit brought by former detainees at Iraq's Abu Ghraib prison and other facilities. In court filings, the 72 plaintiffs alleged that employees of L3 services tortured and abused them. They said the tactics included beatings, forced nudity, exposure to extreme temperatures, and keeping detainees awake for long hours. The company, now called Engeldi Corporation, asked for the case to be dismissed, arguing its personnel were part of occupying forces and thus not subject to civil lawsuits. A federal court denied the motion in 2010, and last year an appeals court dismissed the company's bid to overturn the decision. The plaintiffs accepted a $5.28 million payment in October to resolve the case. This has been VOA's Middle East Monitor podcast. Join us Monday through Friday for news from the region and of interest to the region. And for more Mideast coverage, visit our website at MiddleEastVoices.com. I'm Susan Yawkey in Washington. Thanks for joining us.